become a member of the Movie Geeks United family. Follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/moviegeeksunite, Facebook at facebook.com/moviegeeksunited, YouTube at youtube.com/moviegeeksunited, or bookmark our website at moviegeeksunited.net. And you can also access our entire library of programs, including more than 600 filmmaker interviews, right here on Blog Talk Radio at blogtalkradio.com/moviegeeksunited. Joining us for this episode of Movie Geeks United. I am Jamie. I'm here with my fellow movie geeks, Jerry and Dean. Hey, guys.
Hey, what's up?
Got a great show tonight. A little bit later on, we'll be talking to Sharon Swart. She is the co-author of the new book, Filmcraft Producing, which is all about the art of producing, that often misunderstood position in the film industry. And we'll have some great discussions on the latest movie news. We'll review some of the latest films and just have an all-around good movie geek time. That should be like the Flintstones, like have a Yabba Dabba Doo time. We should have our own kind of movie geek time. Anyway, so let's start the show, first of all, though, with an Academy Award winner. You know, the Oscars doesn't even open with an Academy Award winner, but our show does. Tonight, we are pleased to be joined by Bobbi Yostein, our great friend. Every loyal listener of Movie Geeks United knows Bobbi and her terrific work, mainly her series of panels that she conducts titled Inside the Cutting Room. She has an upcoming event on April 25th from her new home at the French Institute in New York City. That's at 55 East 59th Street in New York City. Her guest of honor during this panel is none other than Stephen Rotter. He is the Academy Award-winning editor of The Right Stuff. He's also edited films like Dirty Rotten Scoundrels and worked on Little Big Man and The World According to Garp. He was a protege of Dee Dee Allen and worked really closely with her on some of the early Arthur Penn films and worked solo with Mr. Penn as well early on in his career.
Wow.
He's got a great career. So a wealth of great stories, and Bobbi will be exploring all of that during her upcoming panel on the 25th. If you can't make it in New York City, the event is also live streaming, but as a prelude to that event, we have them both right here. So we're pleased to welcome Bobbi Yostein and Stephen Rotter. Enjoy the conversation, guys.
We're going to be primarily focusing on the films that we are also showing clips from, which will be The World According to Garp, The Right Stuff, Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, The Parent Trap, Enchanted, and if we have time, Little Big Man, because that was a film that inspired Stephen, and we do want to leave enough time for Q&A, so we just have to see how it goes.
Yeah, well, there's so many movies that you guys could delve into forever on his resume. I mean, it's incredible reviewing your roster.
It was difficult. It's difficult to do to find. There's so much, as you said. But it's always interesting to not only offer a range of genre, but different directors and different challenges to compare and contrast. And I think this is a good sampling of that.
Yeah. So, Stephen, tell me how you found yourself in the world of editing. What was that trajectory like?
Well, actually, the trajectory really happened because I met my now wife who was working in NBC and happened to take a tour in NBC and thought that the world of television held some interest for me. And in trying to squeeze into the world of television, I ended up in a news film department at NBC. And, you know, that included editing for Huntley Brinkley and documentaries and projects of that ilk. And then having discovered that I liked it, I thought, well, as long as I enjoy editing, why shouldn't I try and edit on a much larger scale? So I left NBC to freelance and luckily made some, you know, amazing connections, and it just seemed to fall into place without much effort on my part, just, you know, cruising from project to project, inspired by a mentor and pushed by a mentor. So that's how it happened, more or less. And I mean, it's a good many years that seems like an instant.
Yeah. Well, you must have felt that you had a strong sense of storytelling, I mean, to embark on this career.
Well, you know, I think that when you embark on this career, you're focused mainly on trying to be good at what you do, and you can be I don't think you're conscious of your own talents until you become somewhat successful, and then in retrospect you think to yourself, gee, I must, you know, I guess I do have a good sense of story. I guess I can evaluate performance. But I think on the way, you're not conscious of whatever gifts you have, because they can be learned. They can be inspired by others. And a lot of luck is involved by working on, you know, relatively decent material. There are many people that probably have an equal amount of talent that just, for whatever reason, have not been able to make the right connections or not been in the right place.
Mm-hmm. And so who was your mentor throughout this?
Well, my mentor was a woman who died a couple of years ago named Dee Dee Allen, who at that time, when I was training, was pretty universally known as, if not the best, one of the very best editors in the country. And so, you know, for what seemed like a lot of years, I was working as her assistant and then up to her main assistant, but in all actuality, it was only maybe 3 or 4 years.
Mm. So that was, I mean, Dee Dee was legendary in the film editing world, particularly because her breakthrough was it Bonnie and Clyde?
Yes, that was what brought her, you know, the initial shot of notoriety that sort of propelled her to become, you know, what was pretty universally known as one of the best in the world. And of course, Bonnie and Clyde was, you know, just the seminal film in terms of filmmaking in this country. So mm-hmm. Yeah, and from then on, you know, from there on, she really went on to do you know, many, many great films.
Well, she also called it the Arthur Penn School, because that was where there were a lot of wonderful editors, including Stephen, who trained under Dee Dee when she was editing for him. One of the reasons being that he shot a tremendous amount of film and coverage and needed a lot of editors and a source of inspiration for both. I think it's fair to say, not only Dee Dee Allen, but Stephen. So.
Yeah, and the other thing you have to realize is that, you know, through her, I worked with some of the best directors ever, and the exposure was fantastic. And in those days, without digital editing, you know, she used people right at her elbow, handing her clips, and she would talk like a stream of consciousness of why she was doing something. And so even though you only learn by actually doing, you absorbed a lot that came into play later on in your career. I mean, you know, I always say that not only did she teach me what to do, but in some instances, what not to do.
Mm.
So,
well, I would imagine that from reviewing her work and yours and the work of all great directors, really, there's obviously the sensitivity to reading what's on the screen and knowing what beats you have to make. But there's no fear of being bold, of making bold choices.
That's absolutely right. First of all, there was no fear of making bold choices. Number two, there was no stone left unturned. Her dedication and her stick-to-itiveness was legendary. So it did give you a sense of values about why and where and how to do things. And, of course, her eye was always on the story and the performance. Mm. And, you know, of course, with Arthur, he loved, bold. He loved to do bold things, both in directing and in editing. So it was just probably a match made in heaven, the two of them. And of course, later on, films with George Roy Hill, it was the same kind of combination.
But I would imagine you must have developed a great rapport with Arthur Penn. Was he a constant presence in the editing room? Was there very close work that you did with him?
No, actually, it's funny because Arthur worked, unlike most directors, he would screen a film, give notes, go away, come back, screen it again, maybe have friends come in and screen it, but it was mostly through note-taking and discussions. In those days, working on Moviolas or Chems or Steenbecks, as opposed to digital editing, directors didn't have the same kind of patience to sit while the film was being edited, because it was awkward to look at a Moviola screen, and sometimes it was awkward to look at a Steenbeck. So Arthur preferred to go away, stay as fresh as possible, come back, look, and give another set of notes. And, you know, we used to joke because his favorite expression was, we're getting there, and we always used to say among ourselves after about 6 months, when are we going to be there? And so, you know, it was a standing joke. And the other thing was, as I was saying to Bobby, when I first started my very first film working with Didi, and as like a second assistant, not even the first assistant, she had finished a rough cut of Alice's Restaurant, and we screened it for ourselves before showing it to Arthur. And then a few days later, Arthur came in and looked at it, and he started to make wholesale changes. And I was thinking to myself, how can he make changes? The film is unbelievable. How can he do that? And so, of course, I quickly learned after that that the process was a lot more complicated than I thought it was.
Is the director generally, though, I mean, because they labor over every frame in the production phase of the project, do you find that they're precious about the footage that they've shot, or do the best directors recognize when, no, this movie works better as a whole if we just get rid of that altogether?
Well, yeah, the best directors are able to, they all hang on to things for different reasons for different lengths of time. But, of course, the best ones come up with what you and yourself as an editor working on it can think of as the best movie possible out of what they shot. Mm. And so I think that the answer to that would be anyone who can bring themselves to the full potential of that movie without any self-indulgence.
Well, when you're trying to reach the full potential of what the film can be, how does that start for you? Do you prefer to have to study the script prior to production and have conversations with the director prior to cutting, or do you prefer to just go in with the first frame and realize it from that stage?
Well, I think the more communication between the director and the editor, the better off the editor is. So it's great to have conversations before. It's also great to have conversations as each scene is shot, when you screen dailies together. It never hurts to have hints of, you know, what the director really likes. And, of course, you can always depart from that, and you can say to them, listen, I just did this because I had this idea and it may not work. But, of course, with digital editing, you're able to do all those things and put them aside and later bring them up. Mm. You know, so there's been a big change. Digital editing allows you to both do what you think the director wants and do what you, I mean, you know, there's a whole, it opened up a whole set of possibilities. It's time consuming, but, you know, interesting to perceive. I was telling Bobby that, you know, as you're doing the, as your career progresses, I think the most important thing that you learn is that when you do something yourself, you're able to judge it and say, oh, that's the worst thing I've ever seen. I better start again, or I better try something else, as opposed to, I did it, you know, it looks pretty good. So the self, your self-evaluation of what you've done is really important.
Hmm. I want to talk a little bit about tone, and Bobby, to get you involved in this too. But I'm thinking of The World According to Garp, which is this beautifully odd book, and to try to translate the tone of that into film, was that a tricky balance to achieve in the editing?
Well, I think that the film pretty much laid out a shot. In other words, the director really in that case had a fairly clear idea of where he wanted to go. The tricky part was to try and bring it to life and make it feel real. And so, you know, I think that choice of performance there, I mean, don't forget it was Robin's first movie, and I think it was Glenn's first movie. So, you know, you were dealing, you know, George was dealing with fresh lumps of clay that he could mold. I mean, he was wonderful with actors. And so, you know, I think that really shone through in the movie. And so the movie was this collection of odd things that happened. And I remember that a lot of these movies, you know, were not that well-received when they came out. Certainly Garp was not that well-received. And I remember George being, I mean, George was sort of like, he always expected the worst. So when he read a bad review in Time magazine, he sort of had this bitter laugh about him. But, you know, the Garp's sort of record led him back to making more conventional movies.
I always loved Garp.
First of all, it was my first movie that I actually edited. I had a friend come in and help me out named Ron Roos. And for me, it was like a gift from heaven to be able to sort of, Didi was busy. He knew me from, you know, when it's being an assistant on Slaughterhouse-Five. I was friendly with his producer, so he said to himself, I suppose, why not? But
Steve, you told a funny story about your self-doubt on that and the sounds of the cuts. I thought that was right.
You know, in editing before digital, of course, you spliced everything together with tape. And so when you would run it in the projector, even when you were behind the projector, you know, you were in a regular screening room, you could still hear the splices hit the projector. So it would go tick, 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 tick. Mm. So in some cases, early on, before I got to Garp, when I would, you know, screen a scene that I cut, it sounded like a machine gun, because I made so many splices in the, you know, trying to find the right spot. So when we cut negative on Garp, and we were supposed to look at the print the next day, I couldn't sleep that night. I was in a cold sweat because I thought that every time we hit a splice and it went dit, 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 and it jumped a little bit, that's what made the cuts work, because otherwise, if they were smooth, I thought they were a disaster. So all night I was in a cold sweat. I went to the first screening, the first print, like I was going to the death chamber. And, of course, everything was fine. It looked great, you know. And I look at it today, and I'm just amazed at not only how good it looks, but also remembering the anxiety I went through on that movie because it was my first. And, of course, the anxiety doesn't get that much better as you go along.
Well, I think that's interesting. You know, all the editors I talk to, no matter how great an experience they are, always say there is that element. And I think that's, you know, the creative process. And, it also creates adrenaline, you know.
It does.
But
it's
very interesting that all editors have moments during, especially when you first start a film.
Garp.
Garp.
Garp?
Yes, garp.
Sounds like a fish.
Garp was, like you said, your first movie on your own as an editor. So when you look at that now, or the last time you looked at that, I know that I hear actors a lot, when they say that they look at their early work, they think, oh my gosh, what was I doing? I was so naive then. And do you feel that way as an editor when you look at older work? I mean,
Actually, I've been surprised. I always thought that I would think that, but I've been really almost shocked that it seems to hold up. And the movies may not hold up, you know, because of the times, but the things that I worried about in terms of editing seem fine to me.
Bobby, I want to ask you about your take on the behemoth here in this resume, which is the right stuff, which you guys are going to be tackling during this.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Jamie, I was so excited when we started talking about particularly the sequence, which actually was the first thing that Steve cut, because it's, you know, it's a huge special effects movie with no special effects. Mm. You know, it's model airplanes, it's some very experimental filmmaking, you know, for the sound barrier, this sort of liquid crystal things. But the sequence, the breaking the sound barrier sequence that we're going to show, it's, you know, it was a problematic scene. It had already been edited. And what Steve did to create, he just took these little, you know, these COT cartridge model airplanes with wires. And, you know, they were just kind of goofy looking, really. And just purely by editing skill, in my opinion, you know, it was the dramatic sort of buildup and momentum and energy that he created through sound and image, because he did use sound to create a sort of continuity. But these airplane shots, you know, there were basically a lot of interior shots of the plane and virtually proportional, out of proportion to the exterior shots. And so Steve just went through all this tons of footage and created, you know, a series of sometimes several airplane shots that were slightly different in angle to create this energy and pace and rhythm. And it's a great cutting room scene. And once he did that, of course, the director was thrilled, and then do all these other action scenes. But I just love he didn't have CGI. He couldn't, you know, create this perfect world. He had to go by the seat of his pants, and I got very excited about that.
And the movie has such a great quality of, I mean, I can't quite find the word, but, I mean, innocence. There's no narcissism. It's not cynical.
Right. Right.
Yeah, I actually just feel like I have to point out that it, you know, there were five editors on that movie, so my part of it was simply one part, and of course everyone made contributions. But the great thing I think about that movie was that, in terms of editorial, was he dealt with performance, texture, colors. I mean, if you look at it, there are things there that I've never even seen in movies since then that I've, you know, to work with. I mean, there are actually color tones that you worked with, and you could change the color of a background. It was like, you know, totally, you know, really exciting to do. And it was like, in some ways, it was like working in a Japanese factory. You know, we had aerobics together. We, you know, people would go running at lunchtime. There was a shower there.
But what was also really interesting that you said, Steve, is that there was a point where there was sort of a burnout with Philip Kaufman. He didn't want to look at the film anymore as a whole. There was so much film. And so Steve said that there was a point where they weren't running the whole film for, I think you said, 6 months. And then there was some concern, there's so many editors involved, and will it be a cohesive whole? And then you were so surprised to find that all the parts sort of did work together. And I thought that was really interesting. Who knew?
And to me, well, the interesting thing is that apparently Phil knew more than he was letting on, because he did have a certain confidence in that project that I guess we never really recognized. You know, the other films that I've done with him, he tries to maintain as fresh an eye as possible. And of course, if you screen the film weekly, that freshness sort of disappears. So his theory is that you have to maintain a certain freshness to the material as long as you can.
It must be the ultimate challenge to keep fresh eyes during the process, because, you know, the way you're describing the right stuff, and you're bombarded with all of this material and such kind of meticulous work that a lot of people are working on in a kind of a factory-like setting. And then I think of what Dee Dee went through with Reds around the same time or a little earlier, and that was such a mammoth project. How do you maintain that perspective?
The biggest challenge is to maintain that perspective, and I guess that the only way that I can explain it is that you, when you work on a project, you have such devotion to it and love for it, whether it be good, bad, or indifferent, you always think that it's great. And so it's that sort of belief that pushes you to try and make it better and better. So I'm not sure that you have the proper perspective, but you're always trying to raise the film to a different level. So, you know, there are a lot of times when even a 5% improvement is enormous, or a 2% improvement when you get to that stage, or, you know, suddenly you lift a scene or you cut a scene in half and lo and behold. So a lot of that perspective sort of view is also spurred by a collaboration of the director feeling something, you're feeling something, a screening with an audience. You know, one of the big reasons for previews is that at a certain point, seeing the film through an audience's eyes is a lot different than seeing it through your own eyes. So you go to a preview, and immediately you can sense where there are lags, where, particularly in comedies, where something isn't working. So for the filmmakers, a preview is great, except for the fact that there's the danger of the studio trying to force things as a result of either a preview or a Q&A session. So it's a double-edged sword, but definitely seeing it through a large audience is one way to keep a correct perspective on the theme.
Especially with all of these terrific comedies you've worked on, because speaking of keeping perspective, I mean, if you hear any joke 100 times, as I'm sure you do in the editing room when you're editing some of these great comedies, at some point it's no longer funny. So
you're absolutely right, except that when you go to a preview, if the audience is laughing hysterically, you are too.
Yeah, it's so infectious, isn't it?
Yeah, and you're really not laughing because it's funny to you. You're laughing because you're swept along by the audience, and also the relief at finding that a joke really is working great.
Bobby, tell me about the event. Takes place in, isn't it your new home? Is it take in
New
York?
The French Institute, and I just did an event there. This is our second event, and what was very encouraging and satisfying was the audience is a lovely mix of film buffs and editors and filmmakers and students. You really get a good balance, and I think that's really what I'm trying to reach. I'm very much, as you know so well, driven to pull back the curtain and really show not only the public but aspiring and young editors who want to learn from the masters, and to really let people see what the editor really did accomplish in the cutting room. And the only way you can really, you'll never get the whole story, of course, but the only way to really find out is to talk to the editor and have the editor show and tell and describe the challenges and the, you know, what the nature of the footage was, what the relationship with the director was, what the nature of the screenplay is. You know, all of those things are very revealing and seem to be fascinating to all audiences. I'm always kind of amazed that the public is really knowledgeable and very curious about
yeah.
the behind the scenes of editing, you know.
Well, I'm very excited for the event. Stephen, your body of work is incredible, and I so appreciate your contribution to movies. I mean, a lot of these titles have meant a lot to me, so thank you.
Well, thank you. It's, you know, it's always surprising to hear that.
Well, your movies are so beloved. It shouldn't be a surprise at all. Your work is just tremendous.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, and Bobby, thank you too.
Thank you, Jamie.
Okay, that was Bobby Osteen and Academy Award-winning editor Stephen Rotter. The event is called Inside the Cutting Room with Bobby Osteen, and she will be featuring a conversation and a live Q&A with Stephen Rotter during that event on April 25th, that's Thursday, from 7 to 9 p.m. at the French Institute in New York City. Go to Bobby Osteen, BobbyOsteen.com. for more information.
Hi, folks. I'm Bruce Campbell, star of the original Evil Dead.
And I'm Fit Alvarez, director of the new Evil Dead.
We've got something very exciting for you to watch.
60 gory seconds of our new Evil Dead.
We hope you like it.
The possessed must be cleansed.
There was something
in the woods. What are you doing? Mia, put the gun down.
You are all going to die tonight.
You know, last week I saw The Evil Dead. I didn't think it was... Did you like it? I liked it. I had no beef, really, with it. I mean,
it was really gross.
It was really gross.
Yeah, it was. You know, I have no particular loyalty to the first film. I saw the first film so many years ago, I barely have a remembrance of it. It's on Netflix streaming.
You need to go back and take a look at it again, because it's
great.
Yeah,
I was thinking of revisiting it because it's on Netflix streaming now, and I have it in my queue. But in terms of this one, I thought it did an honorable enough job. I thought it achieved a level of intensity.
Yeah, I mean, no doubt.
That was admirable, and it had a really nice tone to it for a horror film. I don't go over the moon for horror films anyway, but if they work, I'm appreciative of them. And I thought, you know, 70% of this one worked well for me.
Yeah, I had no beef with it. It was very crowded. First of all, I went to an early morning show, not an early morning, but a morning show, you know, and it was like
after midnight. Well, I can imagine it being crowded after midnight, but like a ten a.m. show,
though.
Oh,
and
my
was
God.
Packed.
Who would go see that? I could have – it be like watching Schindler's List at 10 a.m.
What caught me off guard is, A, it works, and B, just how sick it is. And it is a sick movie, but it's good. I don't think it's in this – I don't remember. Like, Jamie, it's been years since I've seen the original –
What's wrong with you guys? You haven't gone back and watched the original two movies? My God, the new one, miss the new one and watch the other ones, because this new one sounds like a piece of shit to me.
Well, you're hearing from two people that actually watched it, and we're so
yeah. I've already talked to a few other people who've watched it too, and I've already been convinced not to go and see it.
Well, I would say that the movie is not for you, for certain. But in terms of horror films, I mean, it's a step above all the horror films that are out there in the past.
I want to say something.
Well, it sounds like you guys are saying that it's better than the original.
No, I didn't say that at all.
I said I couldn't remember much about the original.
You're saying you can't remember the original.
Well, no, I don't. Okay. And I don't have that luxury to go back and watch, but it's actually been, you know, this is the second horror movie I've seen, well, the third horror movie I've seen in, like, the last year, Sinister, Mama, and this, that I actually really liked. And there's a trailer they show for a couple of horror movies, the Duplex.
That looked good,
don't they? No, not the Duplex, just the one I'm thinking, The Purge, is that the one I'm thinking of?
That looks really interesting. Your Next looks interesting.
Dude, I already had a nightmare about that, so let's not talk about that one. But The Conjuring looks intensely scary.
I'm not this big cheerleader of the new Evil Dead, but it's
neither of us
like,
are. But it was good. Like, it was better than we expected.
I guess you went in with really, really low expectations.
Well, wouldn't you?
No, because if A, if Raimi and Campbell were involved with it, I would expect it to be a lot better than what I hear it is. I mean, I'm not going to see some movie that the original movie has this delicate balance of comedy and horror, and it's, and the original the first Evil Dead has more horror than comedy, but it always has that sort of winking kind of thing that's going on in it. It says you're in on the joke, right? You know. And it's, I mean, the second one is, and the third one are much more comedy than they are horror. So, and that's fine too. And I like all three of those movies. But the fact that this one just takes it all completely seriously and then ups the gore to the point where even gore hounds are like going, ooh, I don't know if I can sit and watch this. I'm like, okay, this is going to be nothing.
Well,
you know,
I don't like my horror movies funny. I mean, I just don't.
Let's talk about our boy Terry Malick and To the Wonder. If I had to describe To the Wonder in one sentence, I would say it's the outtakes of Tree of Life. But this is an interesting movie, and if you have access to On Demand, I think you can watch it.
We watch it
on our On Demand. Watch it. I want to hear what people say about this, because I think it's a beautiful-looking movie, but I don't think there's really much there in this.
First of all, isn't it so weird that Malick's new movie is premiering on demand? I mean, that's just surreal in a way, isn't it?
Yeah, it's crazy. I don't know if I really want to take a look at it. I could take a look at it on demand, but I think I'd rather see it at the theater, because I think his movies deserve some sort of like a undivided attention in some ways.
Well,
yeah.
I mean, I agree with you, but when you have three people watching it for $6.99 as opposed to two people watching it for $20, I'm going to go with three people watching it for $6.99. I'm sorry. I mean, you know, my loyalty can only go so far. But
well, that's
why I haven't
watched it yet, because, I mean, I want to give it my undivided attention. It isn't one of those, you know, his movies are such a sensory overload that it's not one of those, okay, let me pause this so I can get my chicken nuggets.
I actually took away a lot from it, more so than I... Because this movie premiered in the D.C. area at the Environmental Film Festival, and it is Terrence Malick making it an environmental comment on where on the you know on climate change and everything. And what there is a very strong like environmental commentary in the movie.
I'm happy that there's an alternative movie out there, even though the movie hasn't made it to Atlanta. That's why I didn't go see it this weekend. To the theaters, at least. I'm still just extremely happy that there's something else to go see besides, you know, Jurassic Park 3D or whatever.
Yeah.
But there's like 10 3D movies out there now. It's ridiculous.
Here's the last thought about video on demand from Malick's film, because we saw it with Tree of Life when that premiered in theaters and droves of people asked for their money back. So they see the previews for To the Wonder on their TV, and they're like, oh, a new Ben Affleck movie premiering on demand. it's a little bit harder to get your money back if you order that one on TV, you know?
Right.
Very few people will call the cable company and say, oh, God, that was terrible. I'm sure they'll still get some people, but not in the theater.
I thought it was Geely,
yeah. Geely has a strong environmental message as well.
Yes, it does.
you shouldn't waste film. I think it's the thing that comes through there. Dean, have you seen anything?
Well, you know, this past week I've been concentrating on watching Top of the Lake, which is the Sundance miniseries. It's helmed by Jane Campion, and I think his name is Gerard Lee. And she's directed a few of the episodes, and it stars Elizabeth Moss who has a questionable accent in the show. I have to say she hasn't mastered the New Zealand accent, but she plays a New Zealand detective who is searching for a missing girl, like 15-year-old girl who's also pregnant, So the whole series is based around this. A lot of people are comparing it to Twin Peaks because it takes place in a beautiful rural setting, but it does concern, you know, the fate of a young girl. But that's about where the where the comparison kind of ends, because it's not, doesn't have that sense of weirdness or there's not many laughs in the show, and there's a tremendous amount of characters in it, and there are a few quirky characters, but none on the level of Twin Peaks or whatever. But
it sounds like The Killing. It sounds like more akin to The Killing, which The Killing would compare it a lot to Twin Peaks as well. But
right, yeah, but this show has a more feminist kind of thing going on in it, I would say. It's really more about how this hyper male society is treating the females in their midst, and Elizabeth Moss's character has a dark past, and Holly Hunter is in it, and she plays she's got a mane of long gray hair, and she plays this sort of, I would say, not a cult leader, but she has that kind of, her character has that kind of flavor, you know, and she's starting up a place called Paradise, which is this place where battered and mistreated women can go to heal. And she starts it up on this plot of land that she buys, not knowing that the plot of land actually in reality belongs to Peter Milan. And Peter Milan is really good at this show as the show's like main badass villain.
42 is supposed to be very good, and I would have gone to see it if I had more time, but I had to do some work at home and stuff this weekend, but I'll try to see 42 for the next show. But that's supposed to be, everyone says it's very good.
That's supposed to be a good old-fashioned kind of movie.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Which old-fashioned, I'm sure, feels new again today.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I did watch some other movies. I watched, you know, The Hunt, you know, which was Mads Mikkelsen's, you know, ticket to winning the Cannes Film Festival Best Actor Award. And I thought that was rather TV movie-like, but I thought that he was excellent in it. And I was a little let down, though, in the filmmaking, because I do like Thomas Vinterberg a lot. But I just thought it was just sort of an average treatment of what would happen if a teacher was falsely accused of touching a student in a sexual way. And I just thought it was kind of, okay. But Mikkelsen was great in it. And
have you seen him play Hannibal yet?
I have not watched Hannibal yet. I'm thinking of starting on that. I'm trying to decide whether I'm going to watch that or watch the Bates Motel.
Oh yeah,
Have you watched it, Jamie? Have you watched Hannibal?
Yeah, I've watched Hannibal and Bates Motel so far.
Uh-huh.
I could take or leave Hannibal, but what impresses me about Hannibal is the look of it. I mean, there's a lot of visual imagination at play in that show. It's probably the most extraordinary looking show on network TV, certainly.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's eons above anything else on network TV in terms of the cinematography. Bates Motel is good for Vera Farmiga. She's really good in it. But I really don't find myself too involved in that one either.
Is it bizarre to watch it? Because isn't Bates Motel like actually set in present day? Isn't that kind of strange?
And yet, performance and a lot of other things, costuming feels retro.
Uh-huh. Okay. That's bizarre.
And it's like weird, you know. I don't know if that's a detriment for me, but it's fine. The only problem I have with Bates Motel is where it's going to go, because it has nowhere to go but really extremely, extraordinarily dark places.
I mean, it's a weird thing.
His mother's
going
to die. He's going to go crazy. You know, it's not like this cliffhanger. Oh, I can't wait to be depressed out of my mind for the rest of the show. Anyway,
yeah,
I saw a few movies. I saw a movie called Broken, which was a family drama. It comes out of Britain. It's Tim Roth and Cillian Murphy. It's a nice movie. I wrote that it was like a cross between To Kill a Mockingbird and Little Children. I like the performances in it. I really like the editing in it. It's you know, it's a multi character family drama. It'll remind some people of American Beauty, like the British version of American Beauty or something. I would imagine it will probably be an on-demand title. I can imagine it being like an IFC or Sundance or something.
Well, it was nominated for a lot of BAFTAs, you know, last year.
Oh, was it really?
Yeah. Like 12 or something.
Saw Casting By, the documentary, Dean.
Oh, yeah.
Pretty good. It was really good. Yeah, it was really good. Which, I mean, it tells the story of the role of the casting director and how the casting director really shapes the course of all the films that we know and love, but in particular Marion Doherty, who's one of the legendary casting directors. But really, she discovered everyone from Gene Hackman to Duvall to Pacino, and there's all of those stories represented. What fascinated me most about the movie, wowed me most about it, is the sheer number of interviews he got. I mean, and he talks to you about it in the interview. I mean, he would track down some of these people, I'm sure, just to get a couple of lines from them. Because they only play like a little part in the story, but they're in there.
I know, but it's ridiculous. I said in my review of that movie that it could have easily been like a miniseries or something. They could have easily done it as a 5-hour piece of work, and I don't think anybody would have complained because it would have been just so. I mean, I'm sure he just got so much footage that I mean, it would have been easy to make it into at least 3 hours. I mean, right now it's like about at 100 minutes or 90 minutes or whatever. But that's the movie that definitely left me satisfied, but also wanting more.
And there's some funny stuff in there. The stuff with John Voight and how he completely flubs his first shot.
Yeah.
And then she gives him another shot, and that shot turns out to be Midnight Cowboy. So you look at it, and it's an amazing portrait of a woman that was very nurturing and very forward-thinking in where film should go, but nurturing to her clients. But it's also a great piece of film history and how these movies were shaped and how the era of the star was redefined when the 70s hit. I saw a documentary called After Tiller, which is about Tiller was one of the only third-term abortion doctors in the country.
Oh, yeah.
And so
didn't
the
they
movie,
call him Tiller the Killer or something like that? Or
Yeah. So he was assassinated, and the documentary follows, I think there were only four other doctors in the U.S. that performed them in various states. The movie tracks those doctors. So it isn't so much for to watch as an exploration of the abortion issue. You know, even Lake of Fire, which is the Tony Kaye movie, which is a 3-hour documentary about abortion, and an intensely even-handed documentary that Tony Kaye made. But that being said, there's nothing new about the debate, really. I mean, I think everyone knows both sides. The only thing that was revelatory in Tony Kaye's documentary, I thought, was that you actually see an abortion. And I thought that was important. But see what we're talking about here, what the debate is about. This one isn't about the abortion issue as much as, you know, why women would go have a third trimester abortion, and the people that perform them, why they perform them. And it's a great kind of human portrait, and that's not to say that I don't agree with everything portrayed in the movie. There were some abortions that they performed that I thought I would not have said yes to performing that abortion. So it's not that I completely agree with everything, and I'm sure a lot of audiences are going to be divided on it, but it does put a human face on it. So I think it's valuable. It's a big hit at Sundance. It's going to be distributed by Oscilloscope this summer.
When I worked in Kansas law required that the patient present a story that compelled you, the physician, to believe that this pregnancy threatened her life or her emotional health, mental health, family health, safety, or well-being. And those patients were carefully screened on the phone. And then when they got to Kansas, they had to present this story to a second doctor who was not affiliated with the clinic. And that's not true in New Mexico. The law is different. in New Mexico. So suddenly I found myself being faced with patients who didn't have anywhere near the compelling stories that they had in Kansas.
I understand.
And yeah, it's a struggle for me to figure out, is it okay for me to say, no, that's not a good enough story. I'm not doing an abortion for you.
And then I saw a movie called Pasadena, which is a family ensemble.
Oh, how
drama.
Is that? I'm dying to see that.
It's really, really very good. Peter Bogdanovich like plays the patriarch of the family, and the family's an assortment of kind of nutty people, but realistic portrayals. It's not kind of stereotypical, you know, laugh at me, I'm doing something funny. Alicia Witt is very good in it. Cheryl Hines is in it. Peter Bogdanovich is pretty amazing. He has this presence and this stillness that works really well for that role. It's good. I think it was, you know, it could have been one of those wacky movies. Like
that's too wacky.
yeah. Like, oh, look at this family, and they're so wacky, and let's revel in their wackiness, you know. And, but it isn't like that. It plays pretty truthful. I thought it was a really strong movie, and the director of that was on our Sarasota Film Festival show, and Bogdanovich and Cheryl Hines were there, and Alicia Witt were all there at the premiere, and the audience just loved it. It was like an ideal world premiere for it at the Sarasota Film Festival, so it worked out well.
Mm.
So that's
good. I'm really
essentially,
looking forward to that.
Essentially what I've seen.
Peter Bogdanovich is a good lead. I mean, he's the lead, right? Basically, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, he's good. All right, our last guest this evening is Sharon Swart. She is the co-author of a new book called Film Craft Producing, which explores this craft of producing and filmmaking, and she interviews many of the big film producers in this book. This is the Film Craft series that I love so much. They're beautiful, full-color illustrated books that are just gorgeous. I spent a few moments with Sharon to talk about the contents of the book and what she learned about the art of producing along the way of writing it, and here's what she had to say. Tell me, first of all, how this came about that you became involved in this particular book.
I had been an editor at Variety, the Hollywood Trade, for about 12 years, and I had been an editor at the Hollywood Reporter for 4 years before that, so I knew the space, I knew the subject matter. My specialty was independent film and film finance, as well as when I was at Variety, I did a lot of the 10 to watch lists, like the directors to watch, producers to watch, screenwriters to watch, stuff like that. So I was friendly with Mike Goodridge, who edited the series. He was the editor-in-chief at Screen International, which was kind of a trade paper based in the UK. It wasn't really a rival to Variety, but we covered a lot of the same things, and we all go to the same film festivals and markets, and so of course Mike became a good friend. He's a great guy. And so he just asked me to if I was interested in co-writing the book. He'd already found one writer in the UK to handle all of the non-US based producers, and then had just thought of me and asked me, and I said I'd be thrilled to do it.
And what is it about producing that you were hoping to explore with your subjects? Are there misconceptions about what a producer does? Did you set out to kind of demystify the process?
Yeah, I think in general people don't necessarily know exactly what a producer does, and that made this book really fun to write because we were actually able to lay it out in multi-chapter form in first-person interviews with producers who all do things pretty differently. We have studio-based producers in this book, and we have dyed-in-the-wool indies. And what a producer does can vary so widely. That was really the fun part about this book, is that, you know, most people know what a cinematographer does or even what a director does, but it's much harder to pinpoint exactly what a producer does, and we really explored that in this book. I mean, you know, most good producers can do everything from finding a piece of material, to developing it with a writer, to finding the financing, to seeing it through production, crewing up, overseeing the entire physical production, and then also managing to make the film, you know, become something that can be shown at a film festival or is immediately sellable to a studio or a distribution company, and then help it all the way through ushering it into theaters, getting a marketing plan set up that makes sense for the movie, mm-hmm. and that makes financial sense, and whether you get the studio to pay for it or if you have to come up with P&A financing to get your marketing and your theatrical rollout set up. I mean, all of that is super complex, and it's even more complex today with the digital world being what it is, and with VOD and all kinds of complex windows popping up. Sometimes you really have to have such an intricate knowledge of the marketplace to be able to do a film justice and get it out on the right platforms and at the right time, and to find a way to finance that whole part of a movie's life. You know, it's not just the production financing, it's also the other side.
What really fascinates me about the role of the producer is the fact that they have to kind of toe both lines, because they have to be of a creative mind, and at the same time, as you've been discussing, they have to know the particulars of finance and marketing, and a lot of times those two halves of the brain are in direct opposition to one another, I would think. But for a producer, I mean, they're the first and the last cheerleader of any film, really.
It's very true, and you would be surprised how thankless the task is, yet you have to be the one that's in control of everything or already sees the end result before everyone has even started work. You know, I mean, they're really, you know, if the director is the captain of the ship, the producer is the one that makes sure that it's the right ship, that it's provisioned well, and that it managed to find its way through every single storm it might meet on the high seas. You know, it's a producer's work is really never done, and that I think is also the interesting part of producing. It's you know, it takes a certain kind of person who has, you know, as Lorenzo de Bonaventura told me, has that stick with itness that mm-hmm. is required. You know, you really, really have to want to make movies and be extremely passionate about it, and you know, and be the on-set psychologist, be the, you know, the parent, the, you know, if need be the person who disciplines. You know, I mean, it's incredible. It's you know, I highly respect what some of these producers are able to pull off in such difficult circumstances, and you know, and they're constant. You know, that most of them said, you know what, it's still teamwork. You know, it takes a village. It's very much, you know, they're always crediting the people around them, but they're the ones that have to have the overall vision and the wherewithal to get it done.
When they work to assemble a creative team to realize the film, I mean, it's essential that the producer and director be on the same page. What happens when that does not occur? I mean, did any of your interview subjects express any difficulties with directors and not having the same creative vision, and how they rectify that?
You know, I think you spend so much time with a director developing a script or in pre-production. I think for the most part, these producers are at that stage in their lives where that's not an issue. And very few of them actually mentioned that it was an issue early on. I think a lot of these people, because they're also creative producers, will try to find directors that are on, you know, on the same level as them creatively. And I don't think they would step into a project if that project wasn't something that the producer and the director saw in a similar fashion. But I think, of course, those kinds of issues can crop up. And that's not to say that these directors or these producers haven't had that issue come up. But it wasn't one of the specific things that, you know, that these producers talked about a lot. I think it was more, for them, it was always about, you know, I think the biggest struggle for producers is convincing financiers and studios to make their movies. I think that's one of the biggest tasks a producer's faced with. And, you know, and sometimes it can take years. I mean, it's, and even if they're completely on the side of the filmmakers, I mean, look, Lorenzo de Bonaventura was a studio executive before he became a producer, sort of not attached to or in an executive position at a studio. And he talked about getting The Matrix made with the Wachowskis and that it just took years and years. And he said that by the time he got involved, it was probably 11 drafts of the script, and that it took so much convincing, not only on the part of the other people in the studio, Warner Brothers, but agents around town. And, you know, and so you look back at the Matrix franchise and you think, wow, you know, of course that was going to be a huge hit. But I think, you know, for him, a lot of the projects that he took on were so not obvious at the time, including mm-hmm. Transformers, you know, which he said at the time people were like, yeah, that was an interesting TV series, and it's like these hokey toys from the 80s. How are you going to pull that off, you know? And now in retrospect, you look at the enormous franchise that he created, and very much in tandem, of course, with Michael Bay, who directed, I think, all three of the first three.
And now a fourth one, yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, I think that relationship with the director is very important, just to get back to your question. But I think, you know, I think that is one of the things that you need to get squared away right away. Like, if you are having creative differences, you need to figure it out. You either find another director or leave the project yourself if it was really the director's project, and, you know, and push another ball up the hill, because it's hard enough to make the movie. But I think if you're at odds with your director, it's kind of a no-brainer. You just have to pull the plug in one way or another and figure out how to move forward.
Were all of them anxious to kind of come forward and discuss in detail? I mean, what excited them most about your book? What did they want to express most of all?
Oh, you know what came through, I mean, for all of them, is they are extremely passionate about making movies. They live and breathe it with every breath. And that's the thing that came through with all of them. And I think, like I said before, it's such a hard thing to do and to do well that, you know, if you don't want to make movies with every ounce of your body, then you're in the wrong profession. So that very much, it was something that I felt from them all. And I think it's, you know, they were all very excited to talk about how they became producers. And a lot mm-hmm. of them didn't start out wanting to be producers. Ted Hope thought he was going to be a director and then realized that his skill set really lent itself more to being a producer. And Lauren Shuler Donner started as a camera operator in TV, and I don't think she was sure she wanted to produce at the outset at all. I think she was just trying to figure out where she could land in the entertainment world, and she had always been good at writing, and she had also been into photography, and so her strength was really working with writers to develop a script. And I think she really loved digging in on a script and working with a writer and figuring it out, and that's how her relationship started with John Hughes. And that was really her first movie was Mr. Mom, which was an original idea that John Hughes just pitched to her over the phone, and said, I have this weird idea I've written several pages of it. It's sitting in a drawer. What do you think? And she thought it was hysterical, and it was based on his own experience of being left home alone with his two kids and not really knowing how to do the laundry and cook for them and deal with all the kids' stuff while his wife was away. So I think a lot of the producers also talk a lot about collaborations with directors that they've done multiple films with, and that's obviously very satisfying for a producer to be able to make another film with a brilliant director that they had a good working relationship with. That's really, I think, probably one of the major goals as a producer, is to find a creative partner like that you can continue to make movies with. And a lot of these producers do have those partners, and it may, you know, in the case of John Landau, it's really Jim Cameron, of course, and he runs Cameron's company. But, you know, you have other producers that worked with directors many, many times, like Ed Pressman worked with Oliver Stone on multiple mm-hmm. projects, including Wall Street and his first film, The Hand, or their first film together. And then
he did Badlands with Malick. Didn't he? Pressman's incredible.
He did, that's right, yep.
Wow,
yep.
Wow. But when we think about directors, we think of established directors. We think that of them as having a definitive stamp. You know, we know that Woody Allen's obsessed with certain themes that he returns to time and again. You know a Woody Allen film as soon as you see it. When you're talking to these established producers, do they are they concerned with assessing their own kind of personal stamp on their films?
You know, that wasn't so much something that I sensed from them, even though there are several of these producers that you could sort of generalize what they're good at. You could generalize that, I mean, you know, you look at someone like Tim Bevan, who has consistently, he and his producing partner, Eric Fellner, have been the sort of indie but commercial crossover machine out of the UK, and they've made everything from Four Weddings and a Funeral to The Big Lebowski and now recently Les Miserables. So, you know, I mean, they definitely have an artistic edge but are not afraid to make just all-out commercial properties as well. But again, even within their entire list of credits, that those films are all very different, obviously made with different directors. And so sometimes hard to put your own imprimatur on your body of work when, you know, you're working with so many different storytellers.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at, you know, obviously Lorenzo di Bonaventura has a penchant for action movies and big spectacular ones at that. And if you look at a Ted Hope, who has pretty much kept himself to the American-made independent arena from really the very beginning, even though one of his first hits was a movie made by a Taiwanese director called Ang Lee, Ted has consistently made films that you could call very American and very indie. So, you know, it's probably not as much as a director, but some producers do have something that you can say, oh, well, that's a Lorenzo di Bonaventura movie.
right. I mean, you definitely somebody like, you know, like the star producers, like a Bruckheimer, you know what a Bruckheimer movie promises, you know.
Right.
Yeah. And final question for you. You alluded briefly to this earlier, but with kind of the changing face of distribution and all the different avenues now that are possible with VOD and online and that sort of thing, is it more or less difficult to get a project off the ground, or is it always the same level of struggle?
I think it's probably the same level of struggle, but as Ted Hope really points out in his chapter, you just, as a producer, you have to know even more stuff. You know, you have to know about just even more distribution windows and figure out what is the right deal for the film and what is the right home for a film, and do you structure it, you know, with a cable channel buying the, you know, the cable rights along with a theatrical distributor that's maybe smaller than you would have had in mind initially, but because you've got the cable deal, you can put it together, and it, you know, it kind of adds up to the minimum guarantee that you were hoping to get when you were going to sell your movie, you know. I mean, I think it's just, it makes it more complex, but I think getting a movie made is, you know, it's always going to be hard. It's, you know, even when the times were simpler, and actually it was maybe easier to get a movie made back in the day when VHS was in its heyday, and that's been long gone for a while. So, you know, I think a lot of people are hoping that these digital rights will at some point make up for the loss of video. And, you know, it's still not there yet. And that does make movies more difficult to get made and financed. And, you know, there are so many other factors like the foreign market and the fact that a lot of the foreign markets, TV rights, are worth so much less now because the foreign TV or the foreign broadcasters are much more interested in having local programs, local reality shows, and even locally made movies on their airspace versus American movies. So it continues to be difficult and complex, and I think just the digital stuff is added yet another wrinkle to it all, but also people are hopeful that it will be a legitimate revenue stream at some time down the road.
Okay, that's Sharon Swart. The book is available now, Filmcraft Producing. You can order it from our website at moviegeeksunited.net or right here on our show page. Just click the link in the description there. It'll take you directly to Amazon where you can buy it for yourself. Here's a list that I thought was interesting. 11 classic movie plots that wouldn't fly today.
Oh, let's hear them.
Okay, this might be difficult to do over the radio, but in the Blues Brothers, Jake and Elwood would have had no problem getting the band back together if they had Facebook accounts.
Okay, all right, yeah, all right.
That movie Cool Runnings.
Uh-huh.
This is Cool Runnings. Darice, Yule, Jr., and Sanka, the four lead characters, would have certainly won gold with a Kickstarter-funded state-of-the-art bobsled.
Okay. Well, you know, this is kind of a clever list.
Miranda Hillard in Mrs. Doubtfire, Sally Field, would have had no problem finding a nanny on sittercity.com. Okay. It's Star Wars. Luke's family tree would have revealed a lot on ancestry.com.
Well, maybe they should use that as a thing not to go ahead and make the new ones. I mean,
he could have seen right there that Leia was his sister and his father was Darth Vader. Marion Crane in Psycho would have definitely passed on the Bates Motel after checking out the reviews of the hotel on TripAdvisor.com.
I would imagine.
There's a picture of a fake review here with Alfred Hitchcock's face, and it says keep
like
looking,
that.
Keep looking, pass on this one. Kind of clean, but it's still a shabby, worn-out facility with strange taxidermy. Ferris Bueller would have been totally busted after checking into the Art Institute on Foursquare. This is my favorite.
That's true.
This is my all-time favorite. Sonny Corleone would have blown right through the Long Beach Causeway toll plaza with an easy pass. Stallone announced this week that he wants Mel Gibson to direct the third Expendables. What do you think of that idea?
Are these really the bad guys?
Probably.
No, I don't. I mean, why? I don't understand. You know, why? I thought Walter Hill or someone else maybe, but no. So would Mel be in it though? Now that would be interesting. If Mel was in it, then I would say, yeah, go for it, Mel, because Mel will be tortured throughout the whole movie.
Well, it would be hard. It would be harsh and aggressive and bloody. It'd be violent.
That's true. But here's the thing. This is what these guys, maybe they don't understand it, that while their individual films have all flopped because they don't have that sense of fun and everything, maybe Mel, I don't know, if Mel can keep the humor and everything intact and they're making fun of themselves, I don't see why not. But, I mean, I, as we've seen in this year, just with The Last Stand, Bullet to the Head, and even the last Die Hard movie, which is awful, these guys don't understand, hey, you're making fun of yourselves. That's why these films work.
Don't you think even on the downward spiral Mel Gibson's career is in right now, directing Expendables 3 would still be a step down from that?
It would be, yeah. I think it probably would. I haven't, you know, it's nothing is working. I mean, nothing is working right now. I don't know what's going on. I haven't seen the movie Get the Gringo, so I don't know. But it doesn't seem like anything's working for him.
It's fine. It's like a lower rent payback. I enjoy it.
My question is this. Speaking of Mel Gibson and the part that made him famous.
Mm-hmm.
Tom Hardy is going to play, and there's a very strong possibility that's going to be very good, or at least serviceable. I mean,
well, what will be really interesting is just to see George Miller get back into the fold, you know?
Yeah, and this is what made George Miller famous. This is made George Miller a household. And my thing is, what is Mel going to think? Because Mel, you know, remember in 2003 there was talk Fury Road, Mel Gibson was going to be in it. There was a big, you know, article in Variety, we're going to go forward with this, and then nothing happened. So Tom Hardy could very well come and, like, own this character. That's a very strong possibility.
You know, I like Tom Hardy, but I don't see his personality. The only movie
he's
that
the
he's,
warmest guy in the world.
No, the only movie where he shows any personality is This Means War, and that's not a worthy movie.
I
thought he had a little bit of personality in Inception. I thought he had some actual laughs in that movie, but you're right. He's sort of like just this low talking guy that hardly moves, and you're like, okay.
Well, guys, in the Mad Max trilogy, let's be very honest, as far as dialogue is concerned, out of the three movies, there's maybe 20 pages of dialogue in three films.
No, I think he's perfect for Mad Max. I'm not saying that. I just can't get a good handle on who the heck is Tom Hardy. I mean, I don't know. I don't know yet. I think he's talented. But, you know, it's like that Casting By documentary. There's a scene in that movie. A screen test of Warren Beatty's, like, back in the 50s or something, a black and white show, where you can't understand a word Warren Beatty is saying because everyone in that stage of filmmaking wanted to be the next Brando. And the key to that was to mumble a lot.
Right.
That's the sense I get from Thomas Hardy a lot. Right? I mean, you know, I don't see him. I don't know who the hell Tom Hardy is, really. Which
you know,
is good,
the other
I
night,
guess.
I watched, the other night I watched Lawless for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And I like some things about it, but Tom Hardy was one of the aspects of it I liked.
I couldn't understand a thing he said in that movie, like Bit with Bane, and I couldn't understand a damn thing.
I had to turn the thing way up. I'm like, what the hell? Am I losing my hearing? What's going on?
What the hell is this? Abe and Mrs. Miller? What is this?
He was clear as Bane. I understand him more as Bane than I do as a character in this.
Man, I don't know what's going on with movies now, but you can't understand any of the dialogue, and when you turn the thing way up, to be able to listen to all the dialogue, Then the movies blast you out with some, you know, music cue that's like 10 million times higher than the dialogue.
Right.
What's going on? What is going on with this? Like, who's directing these movies? Is it
well, I think that's a good game
who directed the movies
you bring up. Because that is, to a lot of the people complain, that is, while watching them on Blu-ray, The Dark Knight Rises, the music is louder than the dialogue in certain scenes. You're just like, wow. And that was a criticism that was brought up when that movie came out. And it's obvious that's happening there, and I'm sure it's the case in Lawless. Maybe Tom Hardy just needs, hey, guys, when I'm talking, could you keep the music down?
Guillermo del Toro. I just got tongue-tied, that's all. He still hopes that he can make his passion project, the Mountains of Madness, right?
Yeah, I think you posted that a couple days ago, yeah.
And Tom Cruise is still set to star in it. Tom Cruise, meanwhile, internationally, still big. Oblivion opened up foreign markets this weekend, made $61 million foreign. It opens here next week. So, you know, international box office, I'm sure, for Guillermo is still a massive deal. Maybe that's enough to get him greenlit. I mean, with Tom Cruise headlining your movie, you should be able to greenlight it, right?
Yeah, I think this should be, you know, I think this is a...
Well, how much is this movie going to cost? Is it going to be like some $300 million thing?
It might be. I don't know. It's basically an H.P. Lovecraft story. And when Prometheus came out, they said Prometheus pretty much, you know, killed this, you know, because their storylines are similar, but maybe not. Maybe, you know, we can see this movie.
Well, Del Toro talked about that. He said, you know, I have seen Prometheus finally, and yeah, there are things that it has in common with my movie, but screw it, because Lovecraft was there first. So he's not letting
that stop.
Yeah,
I mean, that's the thing. He's absolutely right. I mean, but... We'll see. I think it also depends how Pacific Rim does, too, though. I mean, That's not a sure thing.
I agree.
Cameron Crowe's new project is out.
Yeah. Rachel McAdams just signed on for that, and Emma Stone is in it. Bradley Cooper, I think, is doing it.
Yeah. Yep, that's a very good-looking cast.
Yeah, definitely.
I would have sex with that cast, yes. If I can make love to a cast, that would be the one. I read Friedkin's autobiography. I got done with it.
Uh-huh. Oh, wow, okay.
There's nothing salacious in it in terms of personal life. It's pretty much all about the movies.
Oh, that's good.
He has a lot of interesting anecdotes about his movies. He's a great storyteller.
I had a dream about William Friedkin.
Oh, did you?
Oh, yes, I did. It's a crazy dream.
What happened in your dream about William Friedkin?
He invited us to a special screening of a remastered cut of Sorcerer. I mean, we were all in the dream. And he invited us for a rematch, and I'm not joking, this happened, I mean, it doesn't bode well, because you know who's in the room with us? George Lucas.
Oh, God.
It's not good, guys. It's not good. We're watching Sorcerer, and sure enough, it's, you know, digitally inserted Wookiees are in the movie. And I'm just like, in the dream, so this is how vivid the dream is, I'm like, are you serious? And I looked over, I couldn't help myself. And I'm like, looking over at William Friedkin, I'm like, are you serious, Wookiees? I mean, really? Come on. And of course, I woke up, and I was just like, are you serious? I mean,
I had a dream about Dean, actually, a couple of nights ago.
Well, I had a dream too, and I fell out of the bed, but yeah, okay.
And I actually woke up from it, and I was like deeply disturbed.
Oh my God!
Please don't tell me about this one.
I don't know if we want this on the air.
Dean just showed up at my house. And I was like, "What's up, dude?" and I'm trying to clean up my house for him to make it presentable. And then all of a sudden, a little kid, like, turns up. Like, Dean brought a little kid over to my house.
I'm like, is this your Lamla call us now? Oh, God.
Is this your son or something? And he kept going through my things in my bedroom. And I was like, you know, I'm going to hit this kid if you don't get him out of here. Then the dream ended. So.
That's so bizarre.
Probably for the best.
I had my first Stanley Kubrick dream.
Oh.
No, you have to tell us now. You've got a cat out of the bag. Come on.
I was working at some record store or something, someplace. And anyway, the dream was really long, and then it ended with some guy, one of my coworkers, coming in and saying, "You're not going to believe this, but Stanley Kubrick is outside looking through the discount CD bins. You know, he's got a huge stack of classical CDs stacked up." I went, "Really? Huh." So I said, "Well, let's go out and see him and everything." So I went out to go see him, and yeah, it was Stanley Kubrick. It was the 1968 era Stanley Kubrick, like the 2001.
Oh, wow, okay.
Stanley Kubrick, you know, like with his freshly shorn beard and looking all 60s and cool. So he's going through things, and I said, "Hello, Mr. Kubrick, how are you?" And then he turned to me and he said, "It seems you know a lot about me, but I know nothing of you. What is your name?" And then I woke up and I was like hyperventilating. Isn't that weird?
That's crazy, man. I know nothing about you.
It seems you know a lot about me, but I know nothing of you. Which is true.
Which is absolutely true. Stanley Kubrick doesn't know a damn thing about us.
Right.
I bet Stanley Kubrick read a review that I wrote of Full Metal Jacket. And because I did a Full Metal Jacket review in 87 when it came out. And it's funny, I had a friend who was, at the time, who was the college representative in Georgia for a couple of colleges here. So he was working with Warner Brothers to put up posters for movies that Warner Brothers was releasing. And of course he also had to put up posters for Full Metal Jacket that summer. And he actually got a call from Kubrick, asked him if he had been putting up the posters, where he had been putting them up, and also if he had noticed if any of them had been stolen. And I'm sure that was Kubrick who called. But just he would do. So,
yeah. Don Buckley, who was the head of Warner Brothers Marketing, he was on our Kubrick series, and he said Kubrick was such a stickler for every single detail, and that they'd keep he was in love with a fax machine, so they'd keep the damn fax machine on overnight, and they'd have reams of hundreds and hundreds of reams of faxes and stuff from Stanley Kubrick, and Stanley Kubrick would call and say, "I want you to measure the throw of the projector to the screen in this theater." And he would go with measuring tape, and he'd do that, and it would take forever. Then he'd come back and call Kubrick and tell him what the results were. And Kubrick said, "Yeah, that's what I thought." And he hung up. That's great.
I think he had pictures of every theater in the nation, you know.
Those were the times when you could really do that. I mean, because Friedkin, one of the things Friedkin talks about in this book is that, you know, The Exorcist opened on something like 13 or 16 screens initially. So he approved each one of those prints, and he was able to go to those theaters and verify the maximum presentation. I mean, those were the days when you were afforded that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's impossible now with, you know, thousands and thousands of screens.
Yeah. What are you going to get? 400 screens?
Yeah. But it's interesting because Tony Macklin, we just did another conversation with him where we replay some of the great interviews he's done. So there's clips of interviews that, you know, very few people have heard with Warren Beatty and Scorsese and Robert Altman and Sam Peckinpah. But I told him, you need to scan something and put them on your site, because he has this treasure trove of stuff in his closet. He has about 10 letters from Stanley Kubrick, because they used to correspond back and forth. And I said, oh, God, scan some of those letters. One of those letters he gave to the maker of the documentary on Eyes Wide Shut that's currently being produced, because Tony and I are interviewed for that film. And the letter from Kubrick that he gave to him as a present said, hey, Tony, I wanted to make sure you had this in case you ever need to contact me. And then he wrote down his home number.
Oh, my God.
I said,
wow.
Did you ever use it? And he said, no, I never called him. You know, I didn't want to disturb him. But if there was a review or something that Tony wrote, Kubrick would write him. Kubrick did that a lot.
Wow.
Also interesting, this Friedkin book is, when I got the Friedkin book, I turned directly to the chapter on cruising.
Of course.
Yeah, of course. For the Al Pacino stories. And apparently it was a terrible working experience with Pacino. Like, the first day of shooting, Pacino came in. He was 2.5 hours late. He acted like nothing was wrong. He never knew his lines. He never knew what they were shooting. He said he was completely not professional.
What was the problem? I mean,
he said he preferred to come at it fresh for spontaneity and stuff. And he said, you know, spontaneity, I'm all for spontaneity, but to achieve spontaneity, you need preparation. And that goes against everything I've read about Pacino, like being
massively
prepared.
Right, yeah, it does.
Yeah, but apparently in that film, he was uncomfortable.
You think he was maybe angling to get thrown out of the movie or something? You know, because that doesn't sound like Pacino at all.
That does sound like a possibility. Initially, Friedkin wanted Richard Gere, and then the studio got Pacino, and Pacino was a huge name, and so they said, "Do it with Pacino." And
Gere would have been better casting, though. I think.
I think so, but when you look at Cruising now, in retrospect, it's easy to see how Pacino works for the film because he's so uncomfortable in it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's a genuine discomfort.
Uh-huh.
If Gere had done that movie, the rumors that already exist about Richard Gere would have been increased like tenfold.
Oh, that's true. That's true. I can't wait to take a look at that. When does that come out, Jamie?
Tuesday or Friday, the 19th, the Friday. It's so interesting because, you know, there's a scene in The Exorcist, the scene that grosses out people the most, which is the arteriogram or whatever it's called.
The spinal tap, basically.
Yeah, when they go in and the blood spurts Linda Blair and everything.
And that's real, you know.
Yeah, the guy that performed that got arrested for murder, like 6 murders where he dismembered people and he killed a lot of people, including a theater critic from Variety magazine.
Wow.
And he was arrested around the time Friedkin did Cruising, and Friedkin went to Rikers Island to visit him and said, did you really kill those people? And he said, I remember killing one of them. The others are like blackouts. And so he pled insanity. He got out in 2004.
Wow. That's unbelievable.
Friedkin, Marty Bregman, and Oliver Stone, and Ron Kovic all hired Friedkin to direct One on the 4th of July in the late 70s. This was after Sorcerer.
Huh.
And Friedkin came on board. He was going to direct that, and it was pre-Cruising. They hired Pacino. Pacino was playing Ron Kovic. I guess the money ran out or something happened and Friedkin dropped out. And then the director, Daniel Petrie, took over. Daniel Petrie shot that Born on the 4th of July for 1 week. And the scene that they shot was Al Pacino as Ron Kovic going back home. You know,
wow.
That scene where the neighborhood rushes at him because he's going back home after the war in the wheelchair and his mother comes out and everything. They shot that. But then Bregman's money ran out. And so they had to suspend shooting. But so somewhere there's footage of Al Pacino playing Ron Kovic.
Huh.
That's so exciting to me.
No, that is. That would be great to uncover that somewhere. I was reading just the other day about the Oregon State Hospital.
Yeah.
that has that was the locale for the making of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and has now been it still exists, it's still around, and has been polished up and is now a museum. The Museum of Mental Health. You know, of course, it has there's the ward where the film was shot in, and they still have the original TV that's up there that was that the Nurse Ratched said that they couldn't get on to watch the World Series, but it now plays 24 hours a day, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And it's still
that's
the original TV. They actually picked it out of the garbage. They were going to throw the TV away after the shooting of the film, and they actually picked it out and kept it. But isn't that fascinating?
That would be fascinating, because a couple of years ago, that place was so run down. I guess the state kind of refurbished it, but it was a house of horrors a couple of years ago. They
mm-hmm.
had like tissue samples and everything that were unaccounted for, that were just splattered all over the place, and it was terrible, in terrible shape. But I just looked up last week, I looked up a brand new interview with Dean Brooks, who was the head of that mental ward, who played Spivey in the movie. He was in a nursing home, I think, is where it was shot. But still sharp as a tack. And he was talking about the experience of the movie. It's like a half-hour conversation. It was really fascinating to watch. Anyway, let's do quick listener mail.
Okay. All right, let's do this listener mail. Get to it. I want to hear. I'm curious, dude. I want to hear. I want to hear what the listener mail is. So,
okay. All right. I tell you what we'll do right now, Jerry. Let's do listener mail. How's that?
That sounds good to me, baby.
All right.
Oh, yeah. We have a theme. I forgot that. How could you forget the theme? It's so jaunty and wonderful.
Emails going over the pipelines or whatever.
this one's from Steve. Steve says, "Hello, I just wanted to say how much I love your podcast. I'm a huge film buff, but I am always at a loss to hear others talk about film, so finding your podcast was really refreshing. I was pleased to hear updates on Sorcerer and your discussion of Heat." So thank you, Steve. I don't know where Steve is from. But Steve wrote in and shared his thoughts with us, so we appreciate it.
All right, that's awesome. Thank you, Steve.
Tom Sica, probably Sica. No, and it's not Tom. Let me say this over again. Tim Sica wrote us on Facebook. He said, "My God, I've just discovered you guys and feel like I've died and gone to heaven. Just finished listening to the full William Friedkin piece, superb interview, and the Kubrick stuff. What you guys are doing is absolutely amazing. The quality of the interviews, the knowledge, the questions, etc. What an exceptional contribution to the art and celebration of the cinema you are all making. Kudos and 1,000 cheers to you all." So thank you, Tim.
That's awesome. Thank you.
Rena Marino said...
Nice name.
Yeah, it is nice. "Just want to say I love your Facebook page, podcast, tweets. You guys do a great job. Particularly appreciate your love of Al Pacino. I've seen all of his movies and on stage many times. I think he is the greatest. I hope you get to interview him one day soon." Thank you, Rena. William Friedkin wrote us a message. Actually, I posted this on Facebook last night. He wrote us a message saying he can't wait to hook up with the geeks again. So Friedkin will be a guest that will return to us. It's YouTube, where we have over 900 subscribers, over 500,000 views.
Wow.
We get messages there. Yeah.
That's pretty good.
So, Cat Listening is the name of this YouTube user.
Right.
"The series is priceless, fantastic. Thank you for all your great work," talking about the Kubrick series. "The interview we did with Friday the 13th actress Betsy Palmer, Rudy is cool one, commented and said, she sounds like someone I'd love to have for a grandmother. I love the way she tells it like it is. Wow. Roy Scheider. Roy always reminds me of my father and how he looks like him when he was younger. They both passed away the same year. This interview drives me to tears. It wasn't an interview we did with Roy Scheider. It was a tribute we did to Roy Scheider.
Right, yeah, I remember that, yeah.
Upon his death. A comment on our William Friedkin. Great to hear the man talk. In my opinion, an underestimated, powerful director. And taking more than an hour for an interview. I love it. Thank you. Leah Beldam from The Shining interview that we did. Nice interview and cool music at the end. You should do the score for Return to Overlook Hotel. I can't remember what music I put at the end of that interview, but regardless, this guy liked it. You know what one of our most popular shows on YouTube is? I actually have them. They rank them. I mean, the most popular is the Room 237 interview.
I believe it, yeah. But, I mean, that was a crazy one, yeah.
In the top five is the Summer of 86 Cobra show.
Mm-hmm. That must make you very proud.
I'm extremely proud. And that was a juicy show. The Brian's performance, meaning Brian Thompson, who we interviewed, Brian's performance was the only redeeming element in Cobra. The movie was so stupid, LOL. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for Bria.
So those are our YouTube comments. And then Will Slocum, the director of Pasadena, who we discussed earlier, wrote us and said that he's been doing a lot of interviews lately for the movie, and ours was definitely the best one out of all of them. So thank you, Will, for that.
All right.
Okay, that's listener mail. That was very, very, very touching, listener mail.
All right.
There was a list. Oh, hang on. I got to turn this off. There was a list on a website. I think it was IndieWire, and it had the funniest headline. It didn't say six best movies from blah, blah, blah. It said the six least inessential Steven Seagal movies. Least
wow.
Inessential. I thought it was great.
That's tiptoeing.
The best Seagal movies under siege, right? I mean, we can all
agree. Absolutely. That is the only one that's worthwhile, personally. But yeah.
And it's the only one that's not a two-word title. Hard to
Well,
kill.
No, there's fire on the mountain, right?
No, Fire Down Below, another three-word title.
Fire Down Below?
Yeah, not Fire on the Mountain. That would be four. That's too complicated.
Which is actually about a hemorrhoid, that movie.
Yeah. I kind of like that movie.
Fire Down Below.
Can we end the show now, then? I mean, on that note, we should probably end the show.
Above the Law, Hard to Kill. It's like he was addicted to three-word titles. Okay.
Marked
for Death, right. You can go on and on and on. Yeah. Benny and June. Oh, no, that wasn't one. Okay.
You know, I like Fire Down Below because it's got a good supporting cast. You know, it's got Stephen Lang and Levon Helm is in it, and Harry Dean Stanton. So that's pretty good.
What was the environmental one that he did? The one in Alaska.
One Deadly Ground. That one he directed.
Another three-word title. Yes.
Right.
That's just brilliant. Okay. Okay, guys. Thank you so much. It's been fun.
Yeah, definitely. As always.
Enjoy Celebrity Apprentice.
Oh, you know it, man.
Thanks, everyone. Bye-bye.